President Trump said he had planned a meeting with Taliban leaders this weekend to work towards a peace deal.
It was in secret, scheduled to take place at Camp David after months of negotiations. So why did he cancel it via tweet the day before?
I'm Rachel Martin along with David Green, and this is Up First from NPR News. A national settlement deal over Purdue Pharma's role in the opioid crisis has stalled. State attorneys general say the company isn't budging.
The deal was there to be made, and they refused.
With bankruptcy now looking inevitable for the company, what would that mean for the thousands of lawsuits filed against the makers of OxyContin?
And evacuations continue on the Abaco Islands a week after Hurricane Dorian made landfall in the Bahamas.
It's going to be a long process. We have to face the reality of what devastated us.
Will those residents ever be able to return to their homes? Stay with us. We have the news you need to start your day.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Capital One Saver Card. Earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment, 2% at grocery stores, and 1% on all other purchases. Now when you go out, you cash in. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Support also comes from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in issues including depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit BetterHelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
After 18 years and nearly 150,000 lives lost, the United States seemed closer than ever to ending the war in Afghanistan after months of negotiations with the Taliban. But then in a tweet, President Trump called this off.
Yeah, President Trump said he was canceling a planned summit with Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani and leaders of the Taliban. It was supposed to have happened yesterday at Camp David, just days before the anniversary of the September 11th attacks.
NPR's Dia Hadid has been following all of this. She's based in Pakistan and joins us. Hi there, Dia.
Good morning.
Do you mind starting with the substance here? Like, what were these negotiations about? What did it look like that might result from it all?
Right. So these negotiations, they appeared to be finalized, according to the Taliban spokesperson for negotiations. And roughly, it would have begun with about 5,000 American troops withdrawing within 5 months from Afghanistan and shutting down 5 military bases. And there would have been more phase withdrawals after that. The Taliban were meant to commit that they wouldn't allow foreign militant groups to plot terror attacks in Afghanistan, and that they would sit with other Afghans to chart out a political future for the country. And that was set for September 23, that meeting, but now that doesn't look like it will happen either.
Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen, but it sounds like they were also meant to meet with President Trump earlier, is that right?
It's a remarkable and unconfirmed detail. The Taliban said that they'd actually been invited to meet President Trump at the end of August, but they'd refused on the basis that they wanted to sign an agreement first. And that's what led us to this meeting that was meant to happen on Sunday.
I mean, we should say the idea of hosting the Taliban on U.S. soil is kind of stunning and totally unprecedented, right?
It's absolutely unprecedented. And it was met with criticism even among those in the president's party. And a handful of Republican members of Congress did speak out over the weekend, and they were incredibly critical of the idea of hosting the Taliban. This would have also been shocking for Afghans. Consider the National Security Forces, who were tasked with keeping the country together once foreign forces leave. More than 45,000 of them were killed over the past 5 years, largely at the hands of the Taliban. And it's hard to imagine how they would have perceived the president of the United States fating the very people who'd been out killing them.
Well, so what happens now? I mean, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said that the Taliban has failed to live up to commitments they had made. I mean, is that why these talks have broken down?
Well, so Pompeo's referring to the last Thursday bombing in Kabul that killed 12 people, including the American servicemen. But there was no commitment that we know of for the Taliban to halt attacks during the negotiations. In fact, there were deadlier attacks by the Taliban during this period, but they largely killed Afghan civilians. And those attacks had even seemed to have stepped up as the talks were winding down. And that could have been for leverage or for optics to show their people that they had kicked out the Americans. But there was also growing political pressure on President Trump by people like Senator Lindsey Graham and former ambassadors who'd served in Kabul, warning them that this deal risked igniting a total civil war.
Well, and Dia, just what in general has been the reaction to all of this in Afghanistan?
Afghans are worried that the Taliban will unleash even more deadly violence to show the Americans the price of not making a deal. But there also seems to be some relief that this version of the deal was canned. We spoke to Shinkai Karakhel. She's a lawmaker close to the president. Karakhel says Afghans want peace, and they want negotiations that include them, the government and regular people, not just the Americans and the Taliban. And she says it's best if armed groups agree to a ceasefire first.
Okay, that's NPR's Dia Hadid in Pakistan covering these negotiations that have been called off by President Trump for now that were supposed to happen, it sounds like, in Camp David over the weekend. Dia, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, David.
All right, the effort to hold drug makers accountable for the country's opioid crisis has been intensifying over the past year.
A lot of the focus has been on a company called Purdue Pharma. This is the company that produced the opioid medication OxyContin. They are facing 2,000 lawsuits across the country alleging that they fueled the crisis. And so the company has been in these negotiations with several state attorneys general to work out some kind of settlement. Now, though, it turns out those talks have reached a stalemate, and Purdue Pharma is expected to file for bankruptcy.
North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann has been covering all the various chapters in this opioid litigation for NPR and joins me. Hi there, Brian.
Hi, David.
So what exactly were these talks meant to accomplish here with Purdue Pharma?
Yeah, so this is a very complicated moment when the company and its owners, members of the Sackler family, have signaled that they want a national settlement, something that would cap their total liability for their role in this epidemic. We've heard payouts could run as high as $10 to $12 billion. But in this latest round of talks, state attorneys general demanded that the Sacklers commit to paying roughly $4.5 billion out of their own personal fortunes as part of the compensation. The attorneys general say the Sacklers refused to give that commitment. Here's Josh Stein. He's attorney general for the state of North Carolina.
We needed more security on the part of the Sacklers that the money that they were pledging, they would in fact pay. And we didn't have that commitment. And the Sacklers rejected those proposals. The deal was there to be made, and they refused. And so this is where we find ourselves.
Okay, where they find themselves? Where do they find themselves? I mean, what happens now that the Sacklers are refusing here?
Right. So Stein and other members of his negotiating team predict Purdue Pharma will now file for bankruptcy protection imminently. In an email they sent Saturday that was obtained by NPR, they said states across the U.S. are already preparing for that bankruptcy to happen. Purdue has signaled in the past bankruptcy is one option they're considering. The company's declined to say whether this is in fact imminent, but Purdue Pharma did send NPR a statement last night saying they still hope to negotiate some kind of deal. In fact, they say talks with some government officials, possibly local government leaders, are continuing.
But if you have been victimized in the opioid crisis, if you are someone like a state suing this company, you hear the word bankruptcy, and I mean, that could have a lot of implications for whether these lawsuits might go forward, right?
Yeah, this could be chaos. I mean, it might take years to sort out in bankruptcy what assets remain, what their value is, and then who's first in line for compensation. Meanwhile, these lawsuits are happening fast. A major federal trial involving Purdue Pharma and 20 other drug companies is scheduled for next month in Ohio.
And Brian, just remind me about the Sacklers. I mean, they are probably one of the richest and also most controversial families in the United States. I mean, what happens to them here?
Yeah, so there's a legal argument being made by some states that the Sacklers effectively stripped billions of dollars out of Purdue Pharma over the years, and now they want to claw some of that money back. Here again is Josh Stein. He's attorney general in North Carolina, saying they're going to be suing the Sacklers directly.
Many states like mine will be filing lawsuits against the Sacklers in their individual capacity. I think almost more than any other family and company, they have to wear that burden.
Yeah, so basically what we're hearing is that the legal trouble, even if bankruptcy happens, the legal troubles for the Sacklers, those are very likely to continue.
Brian Mann has been covering the opioid litigation for NPR. Brian, thanks as always.
Thank you, David.
All right, we're going to turn now to the Bahamas again. We have a reporting team from NPR on the ground there reporting on the communities that were just devastated by Hurricane Dorian.
Yeah, a week after the storm made landfall, conditions are growing increasingly dire. Food is scarce. Water and other supplies are rapidly running out. as residents on the Abaco Islands and Grand Bahama are just desperately waiting to get evacuated. It is not clear when they could come back, if they could ever come back. The death toll now stands at least 43 people and is expected to rise.
NPR's Jason Beaubien has been leading our reporting team there and joins me now. Hi, Jason.
Hey, David.
So you, as I understand it, are just outside Marsh Harbor. That's the real commercial hub on the Abaco Islands, right? I mean, just take us there. What are you seeing, and how are people still there even holding up?
People are, especially here, are really trying to get out. It's particularly more here, I think, than on Grand Bahama. Marsh Harbor is completely flattened. You look around, there you don't even see any houses that didn't suffer damage. A lot of things are just completely destroyed, and it's even hard to find people. It's actually interesting. Over the time we've been here, things have gotten sort of calmer because there are fewer and fewer people around. This is an island of 17,000 people. Thousands have already left. One official I managed to find was a guy who used to be the head of the Chamber of Commerce, this guy, Vadu Budul, and he's basically saying that, you know, nothing is operating here right now.
Zero commerce at this time. There's nothing. You can't buy water. You can have as much money as you want. You can't buy anything here.
And that is an accurate description. You cannot buy anything. There are no stores open whatsoever. So everything is going to have to be brought in. Mm.
All right. So zero commerce. It's hard to find even people. Are there recovery efforts happening? I mean, are you seeing some activity in that regard at all?
So at this point, this has moved over to, you know, search and rescue teams going door to door searching for bodies. They are going, there's some teams out of Gainesville, Florida, teaming up with the Bahamian police, and they're going in, and they are blunt about it, that they are going and they are just smelling for the smell of rotting corpses at this point. And if they believe the bodies are in there, they mark it in a certain way. If not, they mark them clear and they move on to the next one. I was talking to one Bahamian police officer yesterday. He says they expect more heavy equipment to help them in some of the areas that are They know there are bodies hidden inside some of this rubble, and they're going to try to get them out of there.
I mean, I just think about what you're describing in a community suffering through this. There's no sign that these storms are going to get any less destructive in coming years, maybe worse. Just the scale of what you're seeing, like, is it feasible for islands like this to recover, like, every few years if they have to go through this?
I mean, absolutely. This is one of the questions that's out here, is like, how do you deal with a time when you might be getting more and more storms like this? This is going to take years for Abaco and for Grand Bahama to recover. And it's the new reality.
It's NPR's Jason Beaubien, who is part of an NPR reporting team. He's talking to us from Abaco Islands in the Bahamas. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
That is up first for today, Monday, September 9th. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Come back tomorrow. And because the news doesn't stop when this podcast ends, follow us on Twitter, why don't you? Add Up First for your daily roundup of the most important stories of the day.
And we, of course, appreciate that you listen to Up First. And if you want more in-depth coverage of the stories we talked about today and a lot more, you can find all of that on NPR's Morning Edition. That is the radio show that Rachel and I host, along with Noel King and Steve Inskeep. You can find Morning Edition and your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
You probably know a lot about former Vice President Joe Biden, but what you might not know is how his faith was tested when his wife and daughter were killed in a car accident.
God, why? You know, I got really angry. I shouted out, why me? Why would he do this to me? How can there be a God to let this happen?
Biden tells that story and explains his run for the presidency in an exclusive interview with the NPR Politics podcast. Subscribe.